You're listening to A Senior Moment, the show for and about seniors. I'm Joanne Rideout. I'm your host today. I'm here in the studio with Doug Schaefer from the Olympic Area Agency on Aging, Susan Derschel, she's a nurse with Providence Seaside Hospital, and Allison Weisenhunt, she is a social worker also with Providence Seaside Hospital. Our topic today is discharge planning, and what that means is when people go into a hospital or a medical facility and then they go home, there's planning that happens to enable that to be a smooth process and let them know and get the services they need and the help that they need when they leave a medical facility. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Thank you very much for being here. Allison, why don't we start with you? Can you tell us a little bit about what is discharge planning? I just mentioned kind of glancingly what it is, but what does it mean to you as a professional?
Absolutely. So discharge planning is meant to help connect people to the services and the help that they need once they leave the hospital and really across the continuum of care. Ideally, someone would be assessed for discharge needs within 24 hours of admission to the hospital, because a lot of these programs take some time to get connected to. The whole goal is to support the patient and what their goals are, and hopefully to prevent them from having to be readmitted to the hospital.
And so for a lot of people who enter the hospital, I know certainly in my family, I'm a caregiver to my dad who's elderly. You know, the way people can often get admitted to the hospital is through the emergency room. They go to the emergency room, something happens, and they end up being admitted to the hospital. So somebody in this position could expect to be visited by someone in your position to talk to them about discharge even before they've left.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's some people are surprised that we start talking about discharge and planning for that, again, right as close to the admission process as possible. But it's really meant not to make someone feel that they're being pushed out the door, but to make sure that they have the support they need when they leave.
So, Susan, you are a nurse at Providence Hospital. What's your perspective on discharge planning?
So basically, as the initial discharge planner for the hospital, I go in, I assess the patient, I speak with the patient and the family. I just kind of try and get a picture of the patient's living situation and what they're going to need when they go home. Do they need placement? Do they need equipment? Do they need home health? Or do they have the appropriate support to keep them safe at home? And then I start my planning process right from there, right from the get-go, and immediately start connecting with the different agencies and say, you know, home health, start looking out for this patient. We're going to probably plan for physical therapy and occupational therapy to go out, or nursing. And it's just going to depend on what their disease process is as well. Because again, my goal is to try and prevent readmissions for these patients and to make sure that they are connected out in the community with the support that they need.
Okay, so when someone goes into the hospital, is this, I know this is a question that we didn't talk about before the show, but do either of you know what the average hospital stay is for somebody who goes into the hospital?
Usually 3 to 5 days.
Okay, so in 5 days of being in the hospital, people can sort of, they've been lying in bed for a week, they might need some help.
So oftentimes we have what we call our swing bed program. And so once I verify that they meet criteria for what we call a skilled bed at the hospital, it's called the swing bed program, which is basically the same thing as being placed into a skilled nursing facility, or what we call a SNF. And at that point, we make sure they have their 3 midnights, and I look at the Medicare, especially the Medicare criteria. We make sure that that's all met, that the patient has the benefits available, and then we transition them so that after 3 days of lying in bed, their muscle mass has literally started declining.
Really?
So at that point, we need to rebuild them back before we consider sending them home safely. So at that point, we transition them. Once the team says, yes, it's a go, let's keep them here for another week or so and get them rehab. So then we have physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy. Oftentimes respiratory therapy is very involved for especially these lung diseases, COPD, CHF, congestive heart failure, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. These are very common diseases out there. And they are long-term diseases. So again, we're looking at how can we prevent that readmission. And not that we can necessarily all the time, but we're doing our best to get that patient at the best they can be to their baseline before they go home. And even from there, we're looking at, okay, they're done with the swing bed program, let's get them home with home health. to make sure that the nurses at home health are then making sure that they have a safe environment, the equipment they need, and then they make recommendations in the home to keep the patient safe as well.
So when you use that term three midnights, what does that mean?
So three consecutive midnights is a criteria for a patient that goes from an acute inpatient stay to a skilled facility or a swing bed stay. So Medicare says they have to have three midnights as an acute inpatient, which is midnight to midnight. So we count the first day to the third day, and then they qualify for
placement. They qualify for that. Okay. So let me see. Allison, let me ask you, as a social worker visiting patients in the hospital, a lot of times when people are in the hospital, different people come to visit them, and they probably aren't real clear about what's happening or why. But what are the kind of questions that people could expect to be asked by you in that kind of a setting?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of people aren't quite sure what a social worker does. And so our job is really to look at all of the non-medical pieces of the puzzle that impact their medical care. So oftentimes people call it social determinants of health. So we're looking at their resource needs. We're looking at their natural support system. We're looking at, do they have transportation? Some things, do they have access to food? Most people aren't going to be worried about taking their medicine if they're worried where their next meal is going to come from. So that's where we step in and really try to help address those needs so the rest of the team can look at the medical pieces. One unique thing that we do at Providence is our social workers will actually follow patients across the whole continuum of care if that's something that is needed and wanted. So we can follow them in through home health. We can see them in the clinic. We can see them in the emergency room if they come back. So there's always kind of a consistent person for them to work with on these things. I think it's also important for people to realize that their voice is very important in all of this process. This is not about what anyone else wants. It needs to be individualized and tailored to what that patient and family want. So a lot of what we do as social workers is really try and hear their story and really help identify what their goals of care are and try to advocate for that and communicate that with the rest of the team.
Susan, let me ask you this question. We're talking in general about this. The things, most of what we're talking here could apply to anyone. But since we're a senior moment on the show and we're thinking about senior concerns, what are some of the things that in particular you're looking at as someone who evaluates people who are seniors?
So what I'm looking at is their mentation, their cognition. Are they alert and oriented? What is their mobility like? Are they able to walk? Do they need equipment? Are they able to drive? Are they appropriate to drive? Again, I look at the home situation. Can they cook at home, or do they need meals on wheels? And that's when I then connect in with the social work, and we try and collaborate to make sure that everything is set up for that patient for a safe discharge and an appropriate discharge. And then oftentimes we have those patients that are determined to be as independent as they want to be. And even if it's an unrealistic picture, if they're able to make that, they have the capacity to make that decision, then we try and support that as well and say, okay, this is what you want. Let's get this set up. Do you have a walker? You know, do you have, are you able to cook? Can you cook safely? You know, things like that. So we are looking at the full picture. What's your family support? Where are your kids? Can they help out? You know, things like that. Is your wife able to help you? You know, or does she have some medical needs as well? So again, we're looking at the whole picture.
Okay. So one question that people have, I mean, when people go into the hospital, or even into the emergency room, if they have some kind of insurance or even Medicare, they sort of understand that at least most of the cost will be taken care of in that kind of a setting by something like Medicare. But when you start getting out of the hospital into other settings, the issue of cost kicks in. And so when a number of months ago, my father was in the hospital briefly, and he ended up in a rehab center outside the hospital. And so that's something that could typically happen to someone who was elderly, especially. So I guess I just wanted to talk a little bit with you about, maybe Allison, with you about Who pays for that? Because I know Medicare does pay for some, but beyond a certain point, it doesn't. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, no, that's a very frequent question. So as Susan indicated, Medicare will pay for a skilled rehab stay, either in a swing bed or in a skilled nursing facility, as long as they have met that eligibility criteria. But then there's ongoing criteria. So the person has to show that they're making progress towards their goals. If it gets to a point where therapy says there's really not much more we can do to get them stronger, this is as far as they're going to be able to walk, what have you, at that point, Medicare will no longer pay for them to be there. Another thing that we do in the hospital a fair amount, well, and outside of the hospital too, is connect people to the resources that can help support paying for the help that they need. So on this side of the river, obviously, we refer a lot to Northwest Senior and Disability Services, who are an amazing resource and a great collaborator with us. Again, the goal is to meet the patient's needs, but also support what it is the patient wants. And so everyone's situation is different. Everyone's financial situation is intricacies that, you know, you can't make a generalized comment of, well, the state will always pay for this and there's no strings attached. So we really encourage people to talk with the folks there who are experts at that and really kind of pick apart their own individual situation to see what resources are out there. It doesn't obligate them to anything, but it gives them more information to make a decision about what they want to do.
I just want to take a moment and remind everybody that you're listening to A Senior Moment, the show for and about seniors. I'm your host, Joanne Rideout. I'm here in the studio with my guests, Doug Schaefer from the Olympic Area Agency on Aging, Susan Derschel, she's a nurse from Providence Seaside Hospital, who's in charge of discharge planning, and Allison Weisenhunt, who is a social worker with Providence Seaside Hospital. We're talking about this topic of discharge planning. So someone who goes into the hospital and then is discharged home, maybe needing some help after they've been in the hospital for a stay. You know, what happens after you leave the hospital? That's what these folks are talking with us about today. We were just talking about, you know, essentially how to pay for what happens after you leave the hospital. And so I just wanted to just mention the two agencies that we've been talking about. One of them is in Oregon, one is in Washington. The first one in Oregon here, since we are in Oregon, is Northwest Senior and Disability Services. And you can find them online. You can Google them. They're an excellent kind of clearinghouse for all kinds of information for seniors and people of all ages to find out about these services, which are available that a lot of people just don't know about, that are support services. And Doug, a little bit, can you talk a little bit about your agency in Washington?
Yeah, we're just the counterpart to Northwest Senior and Disability Services. We're both Area Agency on Aging. They're both the agency with the same little different names and different areas of responsibility depending upon where you are in the state. On the Washington side, it's the Olympic Area Agency on Aging, and we cover the coast of Washington, Glalin, Jefferson, Grays Harbor, and Pacific County. In Pacific County, we have an office in Raymond and one in Long Beach. And so we often coordinate with the discharge planners. We have, because a lot of our clients will end up in the ER, they'll end up in the hospital, we'll get the call, they're getting ready to go home, we'll have a staffing and say, okay, you know, is everything in place? Or maybe they don't, they haven't come through our agency at all, but they're going to need some help in the home. And we can talk with the discharge people and say, well, you know, these are the options that are available to them. Maybe they are eligible for Medicaid. We can do Medicaid applications. We can do applications for in-home care programs and all of that kind of stuff with them. If they're not, we can also talk to them about different volunteer groups in the communities. There are different groups that have fraternities and so on that have medical equipment to loan long-term. And you know, when someone no longer needs it, they donate it there. And someone comes out, well, I'm going to need a walker for the next 3 months. I don't want to buy, you know, spend money on a real expensive walker. Well, you can go there and borrow it, sign it out. When you're done, you return it. So there's a lot of things that make it more cost effective to get the help you need. A lot of people, we just encourage people, don't say, I can't afford it, and do nothing. You know, give us a call. Let's see what we can work out. Let's see what is available. That, in all fairness, you might not be able to afford everything you need, but we can get you closer to where you need to be.
So. Mm-hmm. Well, so on that the point of you know, just to continue in the vein of what it costs, because that's always a big concern for people. We've talked on the show before about spending down resources so that Medicaid will kick in. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Go ahead. So oftentimes patients will have maybe just one insurance and they're going to need extra support, but they own a house or they own property or something like that, or they have quite a bit of money still left in their bank because they've been trying to save for as they get older. So at that point, I try and guide them. I still encourage them to go to Northwest Senior Disability Services, connect with them to at least establish a case. And then they guide them to, okay, you know, mom and dad own their house. What they can do is spend down the money, put the house up for sale if they need to be placed into an assisted living, and they're willing to do that. So then they spend down, and I think the cutoff is they can have up to $2,000 in their bank account.
Yes.
And then at that point, then they would become eligible for Medicaid, and then we can start the Medicaid process, where Medicaid would place them in what we call Title 19 placement, which would cover placement into an assisted living or a foster home. They would have to give up their finances directly to that facility per Medicaid requirements, and then they get like, you know, $60 a month or whatever for private spending. But that way they've got a home, they've got caregiver support there 24/7, and they have meals being provided to them, things like that. A lot of people realize, you know, they can't keep the house going anymore. And
yeah.
So it comes to that point, and then the family oftentimes will step in and help at that point. And it's either that, or could they go home with caregiver support?
Yeah.
So then they can go to senior disabilities. Would I qualify for caregiver support?
Mm-hmm.
And I think everyone's situation, again, can have such different intricacies, different properties they may own, different funds they may have. I had somebody once who had a very expensive car. That was something that had to be considered in the mix. And so I try not to say this is you're going to qualify or you're not going to qualify. I think it's really important that people talk with the experts directly at the area aging and disability offices, and largely because a lot of times there's a movement. People decide I'm gonna give my son this, or I'm gonna move some funds here, and there's a lot of legality around that, and so that those agencies can also guide them as to what they can and can't do with those resources.
Sometimes there's time limits too. On you know, well, I deeded the house over to my daughter. Okay, how many years ago was that?
Mm-hmm.
In Washington, it's probably federal. It's 5 years now.
Yeah.
You have to wait 5 years. To escape estate recovery. But a lot of times, too, there's family members that don't realize how much help is needed.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll kind of informally come in and say, well, you know what, if you have siblings, you'll take 2 days a week, and I'll check on him 2 days a week, and he's probably fine on the weekends or whatever. So we try to work with the whole community and the whole family to see mm-hmm. what can happen there. The spend down thing, a lot of people have a nest egg put away and don't want to spend it. Part of the conversation is what do you expect to do with that money?
Right.
Well, I'm going to save it because I need to save it. Well, you're using it for you know, to take care of yourself. And that's kind of a hard thing, especially the really older generation that came through the Depression and
mm-hmm.
all of that.
Yes.
You know, no one's taking my home. No one's touching my savings. No
that's
one's
right.
doing anything. It's hard for them to grasp, but yeah, those are assets you've built up. Now you can use them to help
mm-hmm.
take care of yourself. So, but the good news is when you do run out of that, you spend down all, then there is support so you can continue to get the care.
So one question that actually a caller after one show that we had brought this up, and I want to just touch on it again about the cases in which after a person passes away, they might be expected to pay back some of those Medicaid expenses. Can you talk a little bit about that, Doug, when that might happen?
Yeah, it's called estate recovery. And basically, you know, people have this idea, well, they're going to take the home. Well, it isn't like the state is waiting to go, okay, they're at the funeral. Let's go put a padlock on the door.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't swoop in. They're
sure.
not in the real estate business.
Mm-hmm.
What they do is they'll put a lien on the house. But they will require that the house go up for sale at a fair market price. And then from that sale, they'll get back usually part of the expenses that they've paid out. They rarely charge all. But there's exceptions to that, too. If there's somebody with a disability that's living in the home, they aren't going to apply estate recovery, you know, so that person's homeless. Sometimes it's an issue of that's the only home and resource for someone that the house has been left to in a will. So it takes a discussion. And I was talking to an attorney earlier in the week, and she said that talking to the people at Estate Recovery is one of the easiest things she's ever done, that they're really flexible, they're really looking out for the interest of the people. But mm-hmm. of course, the state is going to try to recover what they can. But it's not, like I said, the black ops coming in and stealing the home. And again, it's using that asset that you have. You have your home, you're going to use it to take care of yourself.
One comment I'd like to make on that is that I've had many, many conversations with people who say, well, I wanted to leave this money to my kids. I wanted to leave this house to my kids. And what I have found across the board is that their children will say to me, it's hurting me to see them struggle and suffer at home. I don't want the money. I want them to use it for themselves.
Right, right. That's true.
And oftentimes the kids live somewhere else. They don't want to
exactly.
move here or have the house.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So realistically, they need to kind of have yeah. that family discussion if they can.
So one thing that I've sort of noticed in just the discussions that we've had on the show is that sometimes someone going into a hospital, especially when they're elderly, is kind of a turning point in their lives. So I guess, Allison, this is maybe for you as a social worker. Are you sort of in a counseling role with some people when someone realizes that their life is just not going to be the same once they go home or when they go out of this facility? So what is that process like?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, our job is to really help them process what's going on for them, to work towards adjusting to this new normal, as it were. We don't want to take away hope that perhaps they could get stronger and perhaps things could return to a different situation, but we also want to make sure we're realistic and helping them grieve some of those losses. I think it's very important that they have that opportunity. One other service that we tend to offer when people are in that situation would be our palliative care program. We have a palliative care nurse practitioner and a team of folks who can help people really understand and digest their medical situation, understand the trajectory of their disease process, and start planning for the what-ifs that are going to be coming down the road.
And so what does that word mean, palliative?
Palliative means, it basically is a focus around comfort. Mm-hmm. But there's a big confusion around palliative care and hospice.
Okay, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. So how does hospice fit into this process?
Yeah, so palliative care is something we say it's for any age and any stage of a life-threatening illness. And what it is figuring out really what the person's goals are and what's important to them and how do we tailor the medical plan, again, through the trajectory of their illness, which could be a few months or it could be many, many years. Tailor that plan around their goals. Sometimes people will say, you know, it's really important. I want to live until this date because of some event. Mm-hmm. And so we focus on really prolonging their life if that's what they want. Other times they're saying, I'm done with all of this treatment. I don't want to go back to the hospital anymore. And if the prognosis is 6 months or less, if they stop treatment and stop returning to the hospital, then we try to involve hospice to help support them through that end of life process.
And so a question about that is who pays for hospice? Is it Medicare pay for that? Or
who's usually.
That?
Medicare
yes.
does pay okay. for hospice, yes.
Okay. Let's talk about caregivers, support for caregivers.
I think that is a very important part of this conversation. If you can't take care of yourself or if you're not taking care of yourself, you're not going to be able to help someone else. One of the things that we see a lot of times is that when someone is a full-time caregiver for someone who's got a lot of care needs, oftentimes that caregiver ends up sick themselves and pretty run down. So we really try and not only emotionally support them, but make sure they understand what other supports are out there to help with the care. I think Northwest Senior Disability Services does a really good job with this, and they do have a caregiver support program, which includes support groups and some funds for some respite care. It's a really important piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I'd like to mention, too, is a lot of people are under the assumption that if they need a caregiver, that insurance will cover caregivers, and that is not necessarily the case. Medicare or Medicaid, they have to approve so many hours per month that the patient would qualify for. And it'll depend, you know, can the patient feed themselves? Can the patient go to the bathroom and take care of their business there? Or can the patient cook for themselves? And if that's an issue, then oftentimes what will happen is family members will hire. We have the agency Caring for the Coast here on the coast, and then CLATSUP in home care. So those two agencies do provide caregiver support, but again, that is mostly private pay. And it's usually about $20 an hour at this point. And it's good for people to know that, especially family members trying to provide the support for patients that want to stay at home and be as independent as they can to have the caregivers come in, provide that support, and that lets the patient stay at home.
And to piggyback on that, a lot of people will ask or say, well, I have long-term care insurance, so I should be all right. And my one word of caution is that, as with many insurance plans, every plan is different. And so you really need to not only look at the policy, but really talk to someone at the agency or the insurance agency to determine what hoops you need to go through, what documentation is needed, and what they will actually cover.
Okay. We are at the point in the show when I usually ask people to give contact information so that if someone's been listening to us, if you think you have a need for this service and you're interested for yourself or a family member, you know who to talk to. So let's see, Allison, can we start with you? How can people get in touch with your program?
Absolutely, yeah. So as you mentioned, I'm a social worker. I also manage our care management department and the other social workers that follow our patients across the continuum. So if you have any questions about that or other resources we've talked about, you can reach me at 503-717-7439.
Okay, and Susan, how about you?
So I'm Susan Derschel, nurse case manager at Providence, and my direct line, I also run the swing bed program. So anybody that has questions, I welcome them to call me at 503-717-7532.
And Doug, you're the Olympic Area Agency on Aging. How do we get in touch with your agency?
You can call our office in Long Beach at 360-642-3634. You can also go to our website at www.o3a.org, and that's numeral 3.
Okay. And also, there isn't anyone here in this show today, particularly from Northwest Senior and Disability Services, but you can easily find them online. Just Google that, and their number will come up in their website.
Actually, I know their number.
Oh, you do? Okay, go ahead.
It's 503-861-4200.
And so just a reminder, you know, that this show is a senior moment. It's a show for and about seniors. Every month we talk about resources for people who are aging in our communities and how they can handle various things. And the two big agencies that we bounce a lot of things off of are Northwest Senior Disability Services in Oregon and the Olympic Area Agency on Aging. Because they are such tremendous, I guess the expression that I tend to use is a big clearinghouse. If you have a question about pretty much anything related to health or social services, you can call them. And if they can't do it, they'll tell you who can. Anything from legal help to medical help to, you know, aging issues and family caregiver support and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of answers to questions out there. And one of the things I've learned, and Doug and I have done this show for over a decade, is that there's a lot of help out there that people just don't know is there. And at least some of it is not income dependent. So some of those things are just things waiting there for you to ask for and receive because you are a resident here. So thanks for listening to A Senior Moment. I've been here in the studio this week. I'm Joanne Rideout. I've been here with Doug Schaefer from the Olympic Area Agency on Aging, Allison Weisenhunt from Providence Seaside Hospital, and Susan Derschel, a nurse at Providence Seaside Hospital. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to A Senior Moment. We'll see you next time.